Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Biz Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Bolin. Today on the show, we are talking with Ed Ayton, who is the CEO and co-founder of MerchBar, a website and mobile app that allows people to purchase artist merchandise. We're going to talk to Ed about his company and what he's learned from running it. Make sure that you subscribe to Music Biz Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest episodes on SoundCloud. And if you like the show, I'd love for you to rate us highly and submit a review in iTunes. Here is Courtney Harding's interview with Ed Ayton.
So you are about to celebrate your third anniversary at MerchBar, which is fantastic. What lessons have you learned since you started the company?
I mean, I guess the first one would be time flies. It's scary to think that we're actually 3 years into this. You know, I think that in and of itself is a pretty good lesson for people that are thinking about doing things in the music space. You know, we have been a live product, like a company that people have known now for not even 9 months. But we spent, you know, well over 2 years getting to the point that we were, you know, ready to launch. And I think that, you know, this industry, if you're going to be working with, you know, the major artists, the major labels, major acts, things like that, you have to be prepared for what in SaaS they'd call like a super long sales cycle. You know, you're going to meet someone, you're going to talk to them, you're going to pitch them, they're going to be interested, you're going to work through a contract, you're going to keep working through that contract, you're going to keep working through the contract, you'll finally get it signed, and then if there's like technical integration to do, you're going to spend a lot of time doing that. I mean, that for us, you know, took us, oh man, I mean, probably on average, you know, 2 years, 2 years plus to get that done. And, you know, if that's something that's in your capability to do, it's a huge advantage. But it just takes a super long time. So I think that's one of the, I guess with that 3 year number staring us in the face, would be that I'd bring up that we've learned.
So what does your typical customer look like? Are they older, younger? Are older fans still even buying merch? And are kids still as invested in wearing their favorite band's gear now as opposed to, say, maybe 20 years ago?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, what's been really cool for us is that the answer is actually pretty surprising. There's really diverse attachment and support for merchandise from these artists. And I think that's because fans wear merchandise for different reasons. And I think all categories of fan do this, right? Some people are wearing merchandise, the classic way that like everyone thinks about it. The first thing they would give is like tour merchandise. People bring, you know, come to our site to find things that they tried to buy at the show and were sold out, or that they wanted to buy at the show and didn't carry around. But, you know, that kind of like memento of being there, right? I think that's the first big category. And that really, you know, for fans of all ages, all music genres is a big draw. Two are, you know, those fans that are in it to like represent their band, right? Like, I love this band. I want to show people that I'm a big fan of this artist, and I'm going to, you know, wear their shirt with a name across the chest, or maybe like deep cut, you know, just lyrics from one of the songs that, you know, only certain people walking down the street will understand. But like, I'm going to see those people. We're going to have a connection. You know, the kind of fan people that are there to like represent their group. Again, really diverse kind of broad spectrum of people, you know, everyone from like the Beach Boys, all the way down to like the brand new people that are, you know, like Meghan Trainor that are blowing up right now, and really everyone in between. And then the third group, which I think is a little bit maybe more expected, is there's a group of people that wear music merchandise as fashion, right? Like the person you pass on the street, like with the classic, you know, the Blondie shirt, right? When's the last time that person listened to Blondie? Maybe never, but like that's a badass shirt. And there's a whole like, you know, subsection of people that are coming, shopping, buying merchandise because it's, you know, it's relevant to their overall like fashion aesthetic and maybe not so much about the music part of it. But that really, you know, I don't think that's super surprising. One, because we all see it all the time, right? The Guns N' Roses t-shirt that you pass, you know, twice a day on your walk to work. But also because, you know, I mean, music is like this touchstone cultural thing that, you know, permeates all parts of life. So, you know, it shouldn't be surprising to us that it is fashion in its own right, completely outside of music, given that you know, artists are the number one followed people on Twitter and Facebook and things like that. So those are really the three big buckets. And when you break it down between genres, like, you know, of course, popular music, and I don't mean pop, but like bigger artists for the most part sell more merchandise than the smaller ones. There's a bar in the music merchandise world that a lot of artists have to get over, right? You have to actually make inventory. You have to, you know, typically be touring, or you have to have someone to actually hold that inventory. So you have to get above that bar, right? We don't work with a ton of tiny bands, but like medium-sized bands and large bands, you know, we'll have merchandise typically. And from there, you know, really across genre, you can be popular in metal, rock, hip hop, you know, whatever it is. If you've got great, new, interesting, relevant merchandise, fans, you know, have a pretty healthy appetite for that. So I think somewhat surprisingly, you know, we expected as a startup, you know, we expected to find a niche, find a specific one of these areas and just blow it out in that one specific area, either because there was better demand there, there was better supply there. We were able to figure out ways to connect them better than other ways. And that really hasn't been the case. It's been pretty, you know, a broad adoption and kind of broad, you know, diversity of genres and item types that are popular with people.
So what kinds of merch do people respond to most? I mean, the t-shirt is obviously sort of the main thing and the iconic thing, but I mean, I've seen bands do everything from like panties and condoms, to, you know, hats and tchotchkes and weird little things. And, you know, are there any things that you think do really well or any things that you've seen that just completely flop?
Well, you know, I think that there's a whole bunch of people out there trying to do interesting and creative things. And I think sometimes they're doing it for the shock value. Sometimes they're doing it because it really is like on brand for them, right? I mean, a lot of these like EDM, you know, party groups that are like taking the pop thing to the like Vegas pop and bottles level, you know, I mean, condoms for them are on brand. It does resonate with their fans. It is, you know, it is something that that I think, you know, connects them to their fans in a more deep way than just their music. But there are, of course, like, you know, those artists out there that you see just putting their name on, you know, whatever they think will move. And I think that's actually, I think that's okay. You know, and I think that sometimes it can have like surprising results. You know, the huge merch bands that you think of, the AC/DCs, the Kisses, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, you know, these massive guys, I think, you know, we can surprise ourselves with how interesting some of those pieces can end up being in the right setting. I mean, I think, you know, a random example of merch that if someone pitched me, I'd be like, you should definitely not make that, is they actually have wall dividers. So like if you have like a studio apartment, you know, like these like accordion wall dividers, you know, some of these big bands have them and they're actually super cool. Like imagine like the, you know, the album art for like Rubber Soul actually being like the wall of your room. And I think, you know, the moral of the story is like, if it's done well, if it's done with the, you know, the thought of like, how is this going to relate to my fans? How are our fans going to, you know, embrace this? And is this more than just like slapping my logo on something? You know, I think it's pretty clear to fans pretty quickly, like what those things are. And I think there are, you know, a ton of opportunities. Because at the end of the day, you know, a lot of these artists' logos and identities are brands that people want to associate themselves with. And we've seen, you know, people have no limit to the brand of the thing that they buy, you know, being important to them, right? I mean, we talk about, you know, who made the chair, who like, you know, what type of car it is. You know, we talk about brands for everything. So for artists to associate their brands with merchandise so that their fans can, you know, take their relationship with them to the next level, I think there's a, you know, huge opportunity there and that they can do a really good job of it.
I kept waiting for you to mention the Kiss coffin, because that to me is like the most famous, insane example of merch ever. Like, just be buried in the Kiss coffin when you're dead.
Well, there's one that is better, and I think this is a family show, but there are a couple bands that have made dildo and butt plug collections. So we don't retail those. But the sky is the limit.
I should mention that if you are under 18 and you listen to this show, please go do anything else. Please go enjoy your youth because it is fleeting and you can think about the music business when you're older. Go fly a kite or something. I feel like I've seen that too. Which again, if you're, I don't know, Nashville pussy or something,
yeah,
kind of makes sense. Or if you're one of those, what's the Steel Panther? Like, I feel like that's a very Steel Panther thing to do.
Yep, absolutely.
So, you know, you guys obviously have a lot of competition in terms of, you know, Hot Topic being sort of the big one, merchandise at concerts. And then I've seen concert t-shirts now in like Urban Outfitters and more sort of mainstream stores. So, you know, who do you think is your biggest competitor? And then how are you guys bringing customers into the app?
Yeah. I think when we look at the space, like obviously there are other people selling merchandise. But we really honestly don't think of it that frequently in terms of competitors. And the reason that we don't is because we believe that there is a massive opportunity to do more and new interesting things online. Like when we look at the problems that we're solving, it's not like, are there other places that someone could buy a t-shirt? The problem that we're trying to solve is there a great place for people to discover, number one, and then two, purchase music merchandise? I think when you break that down, you end up coming to like a pretty different solution, right? Discovery is super important for us because as we got into the industry, we realized there's all this great merchandise that we don't know about, right? And why don't we know about it? We don't know about it because there's a few different reasons, right? One is maybe we missed the tweet from the artist. Artists actually, for the most part, don't love selling through their social followings all the time, right? They don't, you know, they'll do it. They know it's important. They know the fans do want to know about these things. But like, you know, you follow your friends on Twitter. You miss things from your friends. You miss things from your favorite artists in a pretty significant way. So there's a whole kind of like awareness channel issue, right? Two is if you're going to actually be going and like searching, trying to find this stuff, it's all spread through a bunch of different places, right? And if you kind of go through some of the options that you put out there, you know, some of these retailers will, you know, maybe carry 15 or 20 different shirts. Some of them will be pretty cool. But if you're actually going to find something from like a certain artist that you like, you're going to have to start Googling around. You don't know where you're going to end up. You may end up on Etsy with like a bunch of illegal stuff. You may end up on places like Redbubble or Amazon that will end up having your sizes. Or, you know, you could maybe find it at the artist store. And now you go through and now you actually have to buy it, right? And I think when you look at buying these things online, there's a trust factor involved. And I think there's really an opportunity for a company to, you know, build a brand and stand behind, you know, quality of items, stand behind customer service, stand behind the experience from end to end. And that's really what we're trying to do is help, one, be that place where we're going to hit you with relevant, interesting recommendations for merchandise you're going to love from the bands that you like. And two, when you transact with us, have a great experience that you feel safe and comfortable with and that it's trusted. You don't think about, wait a minute, who are these guys? Like, are they trustworthy? Like, if I have a problem, it's going to happen. Or if this shirt doesn't fit, how am I going to exchange it? You know, we really want to create like a fantastic e-commerce experience. Beyond that, there's an even bigger and to us, like more exciting thing that happens when you do that. And when you look at like other areas of what we call lifestyle merchandise, you can see why there's like 80,000 amazing different San Francisco Giants pieces of merchandise, but only like 8 shirts or 8 different items, right? You may have like a baseball cap and a towel and 2 posters and 3 shirts from your favorite artist. And that really has to do with the channels that they have to sell these things in right now. When you look at sports teams have a local base that is concentrated in one geographic area. You can retail through many different, you know, destinations there. You can go through the big box guys. You can have a store in your dugout shop that's open all the time. You can sell through, you know, I mean, if you walk around San Francisco, you'll see stuff in Walgreens. You'll see different stuff in the mom and pop, you know, boutique on the corner. You'll go, you know, to the nice, you know, like men's stores downtown, and they'll have, you know, the throwback Twill $200 cap. And you know, that's enabled by the aggregation of fans and the aggregation of demand. And the reason it hasn't happened yet in music is, well, music has like a fundamentally different kind of channel structure, right? There isn't, for most of these bands, really serious geographic consolidations. You can't like open up a store for most of these guys in one place. And two, the existing main channel, or the one of the big existing channels of touring, is really like an unbelievably limited store when you think about it, right? The tour, the merch table at the show is a store that is open for roughly 30 minutes before the show, 30 minutes after the show, and that's it, right? So let's be generous. Let's call it like 4 hours. It's open for 4 hours in each city, one day per year. I mean, that's crazy. So when you think about the opportunity that the internet actually gives us to pull all the, you know, all the fans together in one place and give them one network to discover and buy things, you realize really quickly that, you know, the network effects really open up the possibilities for people to create much more broad, interesting merchandise at all price points, right? And just to not go on forever about this, but I mean, this is what we live and breathe every day, is, you know, when you go into the Giants dugout store, and I'm in San Francisco, so that's why I keep going with the Giants, but you go in and there's, you know, the $30 off-brand Giants t-shirt, and then there's the Nike Giants t-shirt for $45. And then there's the, you know, the jersey, the standard jersey for $100, and the Nike jersey for $200, and the, you know, the player jersey for $250, right? Every price point's being hit. Every kind of fan can come out of there like having a positive experience in terms of like, you know, getting that piece of, you know, gear that they want for their favorite team. We're not there on music, and we really think it's just an issue of supply consolidation, being able to, you know, justify investing in making, you know, more SKUs. So when we think about competition, like, yeah, there's definitely other people out there trying to sell merchandise, but I think they're doing fundamentally different things. They're either coming at it from like a lifestyle angle, which is cool, or like super stoked, whatever it takes to get more people wearing band stuff, or they're, you know, a brick and mortar company. So, when we look at it, we look at the big picture and the real opportunities here, and that's what we're building for.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, because as you were talking, I was thinking, whose merchandise can you pretty much get anywhere? And I think there's probably a handful of bands. You know, you can get a Rolling Stones t-shirt pretty much anywhere, yep. Right? Like, those are easy to get. Beatles, Guns N' Roses, you know, like, there's probably 10 to 20 bands where it's just as easy to get that band's t-shirt as it is to get a baseball jersey. Beyond those 20, I mean, you're right. Like, it is very, very hard unless you go to the artist's website. And even then, you know, a lot of artists don't have great merch on their website, or it's very complicated, or, you know, you don't necessarily trust the website, or any number of things can happen. So do you ever see people just sort of, and I don't know if you get this customer feedback or not, like, if I'm just surfing around and I see a cool t-shirt design, do you ever see people be like, well, I don't really know this band, but this is a cool looking t-shirt, so I'll buy it? I saw the cool looking t-shirt, I'm going to go listen to this band.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't have like, you know, direct data on like exactly those interactions, but I think it's a totally, you know, legit or reasonable assumption. And I think we do see it in the other way frequently, right? When new music comes out, when something happens with an artist, we definitely see, you know, spikes in sales around that, because people are just like checking them out. They want to see what's available and what's interesting. So absolutely, I think there's definitely like an interplay between people thinking about artists overall and shopping for their merchandise, listening to their music, wearing things on the street. And it's, you know, all part of the ecosystem that if we can actually give people a better experience with merchandise, they're going to come back to us and browse more. They're going to find more things. Eventually, you know, they're going to buy more stuff. They're going to talk about things. And that ends up being a, you know, a win-win for everyone.
Yeah. So on average, you know, how much do customers buy in a given visit? And do you get a lot of repeat customers in the sense of, you know, either A, people who come back and buy the same band's merch over and over again, or B, people that come back and one day they buy a Rolling Stones t-shirt and 2 weeks later they buy a Metallica t-shirt, and, you know, like, what does that kind of look like?
Yeah, so we don't share a ton of these numbers publicly, but, you know, I'll tell you that fans really fall into like two different groups in terms of the way we kind of segment them. on the site, right? One, or at least when we just think about them internally, one is like, you know, the casual fan that's out to like grab a shirt or whatever from their favorite band, and they'll grab a shirt and that's, you know, that's pretty much it, right? They'll grab a shirt, maybe a sticker pack or something like that in it, in with it, and, you know, they'll transact, and that's their order. And then there's this, you know, the super fans or people that are going to come in and buy multiple items from multiple artists, limited edition box sets, things like that. And, you know, the diversity of products we have in terms of price points, you know, goes anywhere from like, you know, $6, including shipping, all the way up, you know, well into the thousands. So, you know, when we think about, you know, the different customers that we're speaking to and engaging with, we really think about them in like, you know, two groups. The person that is a music fan, it's coming in to, you know, to grab a, you know, a piece of merchandise because they love the artist or because they saw the shirt and they wanted to grab it, or they, you know, just want a great poster for their dorm or wall flag. We actually sell a lot of wall flags for people. And then there's the second group of like collectors. And we really kind of segment them out. And the answer around repeat purchases is we definitely have strong repurchase numbers, and we really expect them to keep getting better. Because the fundamental thing we're trying to do is, you know, build that network of demand. So we spend a bunch of time thinking about, okay, like, what's the right thing to send to this person? What's the right thing to let them know, right? It's really a trust relationship that we work really hard on. And I think one of the pleasant surprises, I'd say, for us is a lot of people do want to know. I mean, we allow you, if you try to buy something that's out of stock, you can give us your email and we'll email you when it's back in stock. People do that all the time. We allow you to go in, and if you're on an artist page, you can just sign up to get emails whenever that artist has new merchandise. People do it all the time. We allow you to come in and give us your email, give us, you know, fill out a form and give us all the preferences of the bands you like. And whenever they have new merchandise, we'll let you know. People do it all the time. And I think that, you know, when we look at repeat purchases, it's just this, you know, massive opportunity for the network that's really a win for everyone. So we have good numbers there, except them to get significantly better. Also, we've only been alive in the public world for 9 months. So as overall customers keeps growing, so does repeat customers. And it's great. It's a big opportunity.
Awesome. So I want to shift away a little bit from Merch Bar and talk about what you were doing before, which is Swift FM, which was the social music network. You sold the company, and the larger project that it became part of never really saw the light of day. Do you regret that? And B, you know, had Swift FM continued, do you think it could be competing with SoundCloud or another similar service?
So I definitely do not regret any of the things we did at that point. I think a couple things. And this is something that I go back and forth with people about on Twitter or wherever all the time. You know, I think the idea of a music social network is like fundamentally built on this idea that like there's a music discovery problem. And I think my thinking around this has really evolved to where I'm pretty confident for most people it's not a problem. And because of that, it makes me not very like, it makes me not regret what happened. I think there's distribution problems. I think discovery is an issue for some people, but I think that it's like a fundamentally different thing is where the, you know, where there's like interesting nuggets to be had. And if we're still around, you know, what I'd be really interested in doing is, you know, thinking hard about like, okay, what is SoundCloud doing well? What is SoundCloud not doing well? What are, you know, these other new services doing well and not doing well? And I think that, you know, so much has changed over the last, you know, 3 years, it is really hard to extrapolate like where we'd be if we'd kept going with the, you know, with that core product. But, you know, there's so many people, you know, still playing in that space. I mean, Apple now has Apple Connect, right? It's supposed to be a social network for music. And I think it's just going to be really interesting to see what happens from the sidelines.
I think that you're right. You know, the music discovery problem is one that a lot of people think exists, but I we've talked about this before. I don't think it exists in any sort of real way for the vast majority of people. I think there are certainly some people, myself included, who really love going out and sort of crate digging and want to hear a lot of new stuff. And, you know, I'm very much in the minority. Most people just want to hear something good. They don't particularly care if it's a new artist or an old artist or any sort of artist. They just want something they like. So yeah, you're right there. So yeah, I mean, you've been in the music tech space since 2009. So going on 6 years, what are the biggest shifts other than the sort of move away from discovery that you've seen in that period of time? Because obviously a lot has happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most exciting things is that music is cool again from the tech standpoint. Like, you can talk to people. I mean, when we started the company, I can't tell you how many investors, advisors, you know, just like general nerds were like, "Oh, you're working on music? I don't want to talk to you because music is a disaster, and I will never be involved with that." I mean, there was a pretty prominent VC that I met with, who, when we talked about what he was doing, he literally slammed his fist down on the table and said, "I will die before I give those bastards another penny of my money." And then a couple years later, went out and invested, you know, many millions of dollars in a music tech company. I'm
guessing I know who you're talking about. Okay. Listeners, if you have a guess, please tweet it at us.
And now Apple buying Beats for billions of dollars, big SoundCloud deals, big acquisitions. I mean, now there's a list of so many companies that we can all name off the top of our head that are huge music tech companies. It's really changed things, and it's great. I mean, it's so wonderful to not have the entire black cloud hanging over the space that you're working in. I mean, it's definitely still there, but that's definitely a shift that I've been really pleased about, and is something I hope, you know, stays this way forever.
On the flip side, though, I mean, it almost seems like there's a little bit of a gold rush into music. And by that, I mean, I get pitched on a lot of startups where the story goes something like this. "Yeah, man, I was in finance for a bunch of years. I made a bunch of money, but it was so boring. I like music. I want to start a music startup. It'll do, you know, something, but I'll get to hang out with famous people, so it's all good. I have $3 million. Let's build something," you know? And I'm just kind of like, yeah, you know, you might as well just take your millions of dollars and, you know, throw it in the river, or like give it to charity or something. Like, you know, it's to the point where so many people want to be in music because they have seen some of these big success stories, that then it becomes, here's the 2500, yeah, find a new artist app. Like, I'm on Product Hunt all day long, and there's only like 10 actual real products on there, and everything else is like iterations on the same theme.
So I think there's a couple of interesting things there, right? I mean, I think we as a community overestimate our ability to understand why certain things work. So like Twitter, for example, everyone still, like, there's the joke about every CEO has four different definitions themselves about what Twitter actually is, right? So to me, the iterations thing is natural, right? We don't know why certain things work so much better than others. But I hear you overall in the point around triviality. I think second to that is, I think it's really easy from the outside to look at the way things have happened and think that it's easy, or that it's even like possible to do. And I really encourage people that are thinking about doing that to come in, you know, I mean, I guess I was going to say talk to people, but I'm going to take that back and say to actually make something. And I think that a lot of outsiders are, you know, the interesting thing about tech, and when I sat down with the acquirers, the last company, we had this really insightful, helpful meeting that I still remember today, that I bring up all the time, where they're like, "Well, can we do this? Can we do this? Can we do this?" And the thing about the internet and tech is almost always the answer is yes. Almost always. Like, it's not like you're going to your architect and you're like, "Hey, can we have a building with like 8 different walls and glass floors?" And what? And they're like, "No, it would fall over." In tech, you can almost always build it, and it's going to be horrible, and no one's going to use it, but you can do it. And when I think that gives people a false sense of what it actually takes to make product, what it takes to make great product, and I think ends up, you know, maybe changing the types of companies that get made, but it doesn't change the types of companies that are successful. You know, if you look at it from like just reading the headlines of, you know, the newspaper, you know, Kevin Systrom went out and like just like went to a VC and raised $500,000 and then just like made Instagram and made $1 billion in a year. Like, dude, why can't I do that? I've got $1 million. I'm going to go make that happen. Well, okay, you're totally skipping over huge parts of the story that Kevin Systrom is actually like pretty much a genius overall at the baseline. Two, he's an unbelievable product guy that was exposed to everything behind the scenes at Google. Three, he has an unbelievable network in Silicon Valley that for in terms of initial users, initial investors, in terms of the people that are going to help them do the deals that are going to allow them to you know, keep funding the growth of the organization, to know the right people to call so that you don't hit 100,000 users and everything goes down, right? To have it built in the right way the first time so you can scale it. There's all these things behind the scenes that I think get lost in the translation to people that are coming into tech that would be super valuable to them if they, you know, if they were really serious about doing it. That said, man, people should try. Like, why not? You know, when I, you know, I always talk to my friends in hip hop about this. I'm like, guys, everyone's so like bent out of shape about like the worst things happening in hip hop. Like, let's not define what we're doing as a community or an industry by the worst. Let's talk about the best. And right now there's unbelievable things happening. There's great experiences. There's great people working in our space, being funded in our space. There's great products. There's more customers than ever interacting with us and buying things, which is good for everyone. So definitely, you know, I too sometimes, you know, see the 19th, you know, app for sharing music with your friends. And I just kind of shake my head. And then I remember like, okay, this is all just part of the same thing. It's all part of a system, part of a cycle. And, you know, let's go back to like really loving, you know, the new layout that they're doing on SoundCloud, or like being amazed how, you know, a lot of the RDO design elements get pulled directly into iOS 8. You know, we've got some of the best people in the world working in our space. We're the first people that get to see a lot of the cool things that happen. You know, I try to focus on that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should be less cynical. maybe I need to move to the West Coast so I can be less cynical. But, you know, I think some of it is I have no problem with people building things. And I really like it when people go to Hack Days or they build something so they can learn something, right? Like if you want to build another like, oh, collaborative playlist app because you want to learn how a certain API works, like that's awesome. I have no issues with that. I think that the challenge is when people try to like make it into a business and think that there's like a there beyond I built this thing for fun and my friends are going to use it. I think that's, to me, like people have a really hard time differentiating like what's an actual standalone business idea versus like what's a cool fun app that I made that I can give to my friends and raise some money and it's, you know, use it as part of my portfolio.
So I'm actually going to just hopefully knowing you're on the East Coast and you know, cynical, hopefully I'm not going to open up can of worms here, but I'm going to just really disagree with you. Yeah, I think that for startups, that the problems that you solve come typically in different order, right? For us, it's not so much of an issue. We are clearly a retailer. Like we clearly are a business that will clearly be judged on revenues and profits, right? And obviously it's ultimate, you know, the ultimate size that we'll be, but like we fit into a pretty easy box. That said, I think there's a lot of other examples that may be, you know, counterintuitive, but that the first problem most of these companies have is building something that people want to use at all for free. That literally getting over the hump of users will use this thing and it's actually interesting or fun or solving a problem for them is very frequently, I won't say always, but I think it's enough that it's worthwhile, is it's a totally separate problem from how do we make money with it. And you look at most of the biggest companies out there, whether it's the Googles, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Instagrams, Snapchat, all these companies, I mean, even Uber right now, right? Uber's losing a ton of money. If people look at Uber and say, well, this isn't a real business because they're losing $400 or $400 million a month, I think that that's a way of looking at the business that doesn't necessarily realize that these are companies that are building for the future. And for many applications, for many consumer products, the first thing you have to do is just make something that people use. And that's typically a separate problem from how do we make money. So obviously, there's tons of exceptions to that. But I don't actually have any problem. And in fact, many times, I talk to people, I'm like, dude, don't worry about it. You're going to make money. You can raise money right now. It's okay. You're not going to have to give away 90% of your company or all the board seats. You know, like you can find great investors and work with them to build something. And if you build something that people love, if they truly love it, you'll figure out a way to make money from it later.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, the sort of shift in use case is interesting because, you know, I look at Twitter and I remember when I first saw Twitter thinking, this is stupid. Who's going to use this, right? Like, oh my God, why would I want to post about what I had for breakfast? And I wasn't the only person that said that. And then I forget where it might have been, like the Arab Spring was really sort of this first case where you saw people using Twitter to communicate and share news and doing something really vital that was not just like, oh, I had a good day or, oh, I'm eating a muffin. But it was like, oh, I'm in Tahrir Square getting tear gassed. Here's what is happening. You know, the world is watching. And that was a whole different thing for Twitter. And that was a big fundamental shift for them. And, you know, even more recently, something like Meerkat, where in New York a couple of months ago, there was a terrible building fire in the East Village. And people were on the scene with Meerkat, you know, people who were just on the street. And news outlets started picking up those Meerkat streams because they couldn't get their vans into the East Village for a while. So, you know, again, Meerkat went very quickly from like, oh, this is silly, to, oh, this is actually very interesting. And since then, I think it might have gone backwards a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I totally get what you're saying. I totally think that people shouldn't be super hung up on how am I going to monetize immediately. I just think that there is kind of this rush into music where you wind up getting a lot of very sort of similar knockoff-y feeling products.
Yeah. I'm glad we're in different cities because I'm going to come at you again, Courtney. I'm going to go ham really quick. So this is a conversation, and if this wasn't a music, you know, industry podcast, I wouldn't necessarily go in on it, but I think it's really important. You know, so my girlfriend's a physician, right? You know, we come home at the end of the day and it's like, honey, how was your day? And she's talking to me about like the life and death decisions that they did. And she says, how was your day? And I'm like, oh, we like just got in some sweet new like Kiss bobbleheads. And then we like both like look at each other and like cock our heads. And you know, the thing about it is it's easy to think that things that involve like death and dying are way more important than everything else. But the thing that I think about frequently is it's all the space in between that's like really important. And it's like the happiness and joy that we get in life is typically not from, you know, these like big important things, right? It's the little things. And it's your favorite band. It's, you know, putting together like a great outfit and like walking down the street and feeling like a boss. Like there's actually, I read a book a while ago that was talking about, it was a book about relationships. And one of the interesting things in it was, you know, when the psychologist was doing work in, you know, work in their training, they spent a bunch of time in Haiti after the earthquake. And one of the things she said was, you know, what's interesting is, even though we're in the middle of like this literally life and death scenario, people have lost, you know, members of their family, people don't know where they're going to be living. She said, you know, most of what I talked about with these people was, oh, this guy in the neighboring village and I, like, we really like had this thing. Like, I wonder if he's okay. Or like, oh, like me and my wife are like thinking about whatever in our relationship. And I think, you know, the takeaway for me is, you know, there's a lot of simple, wonderful joy that people get from things that other people call trivial. And whether that is Angry Birds or Led Zeppelin, I personally think that stuff is super important. And it's really like the, you know, it's the you know, the middle of the, you know, it's the gooey center of life. And that spending time on making great experiences for people, you know, regardless, is, I personally think it's incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you. And it's funny because I know some people that have worked in refugee camps, and you'd think that people would just be like, people assign refugees almost this mythical status of like, oh, these people are survivors and they're so serious and wonderful. And then you actually talk to them and they're just people, and they talk about the same petty BS that like the Real Housewives talk about, right? So like, you're in a Syrian refugee camp, but like, your neighbor's a bitch. So you're not like, so the macro of like, I'm in a refugee camp, what has my life become? That's almost too much to think about. So then you're like, oh, well, you know, I like this guy, or he looked at me funny, or my neighbor's a catty gossip, you know, and we're going to fight. Like, I get that. And I get that building incredible experiences for people is a really valid, worthwhile thing to do. So I don't disagree there. I think where it comes in with me is, I would honestly just like to see a little bit more boundary pushing in the music space. I don't think there's a lack of intelligent people or a lack of money per se. I think I see this people solving the same problem over and over. And that to me gets sort of frustrating, because I think there are other interesting problems in the music space that could be solved. And I feel like people just sort of everyone sort of like runs in one direction where they're like, oh, this is the thing to do this year, where there's a whole lot of other cool stuff that people could be iterating on that maybe they're not, because people get super focused on like, oh, I'm going to build a discovery app, or I'm going to build a, you know, concert app, or I'm going to build like, and it just seems like people sort of have a little bit of a herd mentality. And I think that's where my frustration comes from, is not that people are building stuff. It's that this sort of like herd mentality where we're in a space where there's so much cool stuff to be done.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the herd mentality thing is definitely real. And I'd say that, you know, a lot of it has to do with kind of this concept of like self-fulfilling prophecy. And a lot of that has to do with when something actually starts working somewhere, or when a community, like an investor community, like VCs, you know, become convinced that there's actually going to be a there, that completely changes the dynamics of everything that's going on. So just to give you an example, right? We will see, you know, 3 years ago was like the year of VR. Like it was the year that VR like blew up. And, you know, we had the Oculus acquisition. We had, you know, the huge company from Google, who I'm forgetting their name right now. But like all this stuff happened at once. And it's like, okay, well, why did it happen right now? And really, I think what happened was people started seeing prototypes that actually showed them that this was going to work. And if you believe, if it's your job to be the person that writes the $10 million check that turns into the multi-billion dollar company, and you're looked at by your peers in your community, and you think you've finally found the company, you're going to write the check. And the minute you do that, everyone else is going to take a step back and say, whoa, you know, whoever it is, you know, Teresa thinks this is the time. We better like really think about what she thinks, and maybe we're missing something. So we should jump in too. And when all of a sudden these companies that maybe have been toiling for 10 years, and it's usually not the same companies, but the space has been toiling, get that this infusion, well, now, like, actually, there's enough money to make a lot more progress a lot more quickly. So now we take something that's, like, kind of working, that now is the seeds of working. We've injected it with a bunch of money. We now have competition in it. And this cycle actually ends up accelerating things. And you see these working, and you see them not working, right? You see that, like, right now, I mean, Bitcoin, right? I mean, Bitcoin was around before everyone started dumping money into Bitcoin. But it happened because enough people started doing it that the people that weren't doing it said, well, wait a second, what are these guys, you know, what are they thinking that I'm not seeing? And you see that happen, the same thing in the music space. You see it happen everywhere. And that's actually just a kind of inside baseball kind of explanation as to why there is so much herd mentality. It's a combination of like not wanting to miss things and like the acceleration that happens when a space gets exciting. So, you know, now's a good time for music. Hopefully we've got, you know, we can subdivide music to have the different aspects of it continue to be interesting to people for a very long time. That's roughly how, from my perspective, it rolls.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, because I think about in just music in general, you know, I came up in the early 90s, and I remember when grunge broke, and all of a sudden every record label on earth flew to the Pacific Northwest, where I'm from, and signed everyone with a guitar and a heroin problem because they were like, grunge, it's the thing. So, you know, the herd mentality in music has been very real for many, many years before everyone started building, you know, apps about live concerts or sharing music with your friends or, you know, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny how everything sort of comes around. And you're right. I mean, when people see opportunities, they go where the opportunity is. If it's virtual reality or, you know, Bitcoin or, you know, self-driving cars, you know, white, I guess that's where people are going to go.
White rappers, a cappella groups, like all of a sudden, like, you know, Britney Spears comes out and they're like, oh my God, we need a young girl singer. Christina, who by the way is amazing. But like, now it's your time to shine. Or like, oh, like, you know, you see it all the time. You're right. It's a really good analogy.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, musically now, again, it's like, oh, there's going to be the Meghan Trainor knockoffs, or I think Meghan Trainor is herself a knockoff, but like, yeah, eventually it gets diluted. I mean, I think what's happened with some of these apps is the exact same thing that's happened with certain types of music is, you know, you have one app that comes out and does pretty well. So you've got a music app or you've got an artist who's sort of like the first mover. And then everyone's like, oh, this is doing well. I can build this better because this first thing misses this feature or this first thing doesn't have this. And then you sort of keep going and keep going, but what you're getting is like copies of copies of copies. And then, you know, where you started with Nirvana and then you maybe went to Pearl Jam, eventually sort of goes down to like Collective Soul, poor Collective Soul, you know, and then that's just sort of, and that's where the movement sort of dies out. And so what you've seen with music apps is like, you start with like a SoundCloud and then as like this great sort of interesting music discovery space. And then you get similar apps, but then everything sort of falls off a cliff. And now you have just like a ton of apps. And we're sort of getting to the tail end of that movement because people are realizing like, okay, this has run its course.
Yep. Totally agree. Totally
agree. Did I just insult your favorite band?
Hey, you know,
you're like, I'm a huge Collective Soul fan.
I got to stand up for Meghan Trainor. We're working with Meghan and her team. They're great. We love them. I have no opinion on her musical, you know, endeavors other than they're a great team. And every time I have to listen to it or that I do listen to it, it's stuck in my head for days. Amazing, yes. Amazing work.
It is very catchy. I'll totally say that. Well, cool. I think we've gone for almost an hour, so I'll let you get back to your life and your company that you run. If people want to find you online, where can they look you up?
Obviously merchbar.com or merchbar in the app store. Me personally, I'm at aten.co, aten.co, and on the tweets at aten.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thank you to Hypebot for helping us put this show out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion.